I just want to say up front that the talk today may raise some emotional things for you. I will be addressing some painful topics, although not in great detail, but in general. And I just think that's the nature of the passage that's before us today, that addresses some things that are painful. So if you find you have to leave during the talk because of just things that it's raising, then that's okay. I won't mind. In fact, I won't even necessarily assume that unless I can see the tears streaming down your face. I'm not speaking about these things because I want to cause people pain or discomfort, but I am speaking about them because I want to be real, because the Bible's real. God addresses the world as we face it, and that world includes many dark things. Now, all that said, if you happen to see someone leave, then don't assume it's because of something this talk's raised for them, because I have people walking out of my talks all the time. And I just always assume it's because they've got to get to a class or an appointment on the other side of the campus. So that's the assumption I'll be making. And but if it raises something for you that you want to talk over with later, either with myself or perhaps with my wife, Jen, or with one of the other older women, then I really encourage you to do that. When Ivan the Terrible of Russia wanted to marry, he commanded all the nobles in his realm, on pain of execution, to send their eligible daughters to Moscow for inspection. 1,500 girls were brought, and he chose the one he wanted. She naturally didn't have any choice in the matter, nor did any of his other wives who came later. In the Bible, the book of Esther describes another similar ruler, King Xerxes. He held a feast for his nobles and generals, and this celebration, we're told, lasted for 180 days. He displayed his wealth and his power and his greatness, and at the end of that time, he capped it all off with a lavish, week-long banquet. And at the end of that week, he commanded his attendants to bring his wife, Queen Vashti, so that he might show off her beauty to the other guests. She was just one more demonstration of his wealth and power, just like the gold goblets he used to serve wine. Queen Vashti refused. She didn't come. And the king's advisers told Xerxes that he could not let this go unpunished. If word of it got out, then everywhere other women would begin to despise and disobey their husbands too. So how did Xerxes respond? Well, he banned Vashti forever from the king's presence. No more could she ever approach him. And a search was made for a replacement, another queen to take her spot. The king appointed officials. He sent them throughout his realm to search for beautiful young virgins. And all who were found were brought to his capital city. They were subjected to months of extensive beauty treatments. And then one by one, they were brought to the king for just one night so that he could try them out. After that night, they were dispatched to a second harem, never to be called again unless he summoned them by name. Now, I could multiply examples from the Bible or from history, but let me just give you one more example. The first recorded instance of polygamy in the Bible. In Genesis 4, verse 23 and 24, we read this. Lamech said to his wives, "Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times." Now, why did Lamech sing this song to his wives? I wonder how this boasting of violence and murder went down with them. I wonder how it made these two women feel. You know, I doubt very much that it increased their love or respect of him. I suspect that they responded with repulsion, that they felt intimidated and terrified. In our fallen and broken world, sex and power have become darkly intertwined. Relationships between men and women are no longer a matter of harmony and balance, but of competition and conflict and struggle. Men use power to get sex and use sex as an instrument of power, and women are usually the victims. In fact, it's just as God said it would be when he cursed the world after Adam and Eve had sinned. Genesis 3 verse 16, to the woman he said, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you'll give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. He will rule over you. Friends, this is part of the curse. But this wasn't God's intention for our relationships from the beginning, nor was this God's purpose for marriage. Man and woman were created to rule, but not to rule each other. They were created together in God's image to rule over the rest of creation. They were given to one another in a relationship of freedom and mutual love and delight. But now we're far from the Garden of Eden, and we're far from relationships like that. Last week, you may remember if you were here, I suggested that this book, The Song of Songs, draws a contrast. It contrasts two types of relationship between men and women. One type of relationship places the male in the dominant position, from which he uses his strength to control the woman for his own ends. In the other type of relationship, there is free, uninhibited, mutual self-giving of each toward the other. This is the contrast between marriage in Genesis 2 and marriage in Genesis 3, between relationships in the garden and relationships in the wilderness, between bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. Song of Songs tells the story of two lovers. One, a country girl, lived a hard life at the hands of powerful men. First, she was pushed around by her brothers and forced to do hard labour in the vineyards. Then she was claimed by Solomon and brought into the king's harem. The other lover is a shepherd who has eyes only for her. It's the story of their fierce commitment and their unyielding devotion to one another. For over their pure love hangs the spectre of men like Solomon, men who use women in their own self-serving games of sex and power. This contrast and this story, which we began last week, continues in chapter 3. Now, Song of Songs chapter 3 starts with a dream sequence. In fact, I think these chapters, chapters 3 to 6, I'm juggling papers all the time, chapters 3 to 6 give us a dream sequence. It's a bit hard to know where it ends. I'm not precisely sure where it ends, but I want to show you a couple of verses so you get a sort of sense of what's going here. So if you look at chapter 3, verse 1, all night long on my bed I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. And then flick over to chapter 5, verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. See, what's being described in these chapters are the woman's dreams, as she lies on her bed, sleeping all night long. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether the entirety of these chapters are dreams, or whether they're just sort of surrounded by dreams. I think it's probably supposed to be one long dream sequence. Nor am I entirely sure where it ends, because when you get to chapter 5 and you've got this dream that begins in verse 2, it just kind of spills over into the following chapters in what may or may not be dream. I'm not really sure. But in any case, we've got this dream sequence here. Now, those two sections I just read, 3 verse 1 and 5 verse 2, they begin two units, two episodes, that have a lot of similarities. We're going to see them, you will see them by the end of this talk. Both of those sequences begin in bed at night, involve the futile search throughout the city, an encounter with the city watch, and a closing charge to the daughters of Jerusalem. What's more, in this, from chapters 3 to 5, there are some strong verbal and thematic links throughout each of the episodes. I'm going to trace 4 episodes in a moment. But so the first episode, which I think is chapter 3, verses 1 to 5, that mentions a bed, a mother, nighttime, and holding on to something. And the next section, verses 6 to 11, repeats all of those ideas, a bed, a mother, nighttime, holding on to something. What's more, 6 to 11 mention myrrh, incense, warriors, Lebanon, a wedding, and a wilderness. In chapter 4, we have myrrh, incense, warriors, Lebanon, a bride, and a garden. And likewise, there are more connections between the last two sections. So we're in 4 verse 12, chapter 4 verse 12. The woman is described as a garden locked up, a springing close, a sealed fountain. And in 5, verse 4 and 5, we again encounter the woman locked away inside when her lover comes looking. So we see these kind of themes that spill over from one section to the next and just keep us flowing on through this dream sequence. It's a tightly connected section of the book. Well, let's look at each of the 4 episodes in turn. The first I've called Love Lost and Found, chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. I nearly called it Searching for Love in an Uncertain World. I was kind of toying out between two titles here. Love Lost and Found, Searching for Love in an Uncertain World. Look at verse 1. All night long on my bed I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. Now she doesn't mean here in verse 1 that she looked for him in her bed. She means that while she was in her bed, she sought him in her dreams. They're dreams that are laced with desire and desperation and anxiety. Look at the next few verses. I looked for him but did not find him. I'll get up now and go about the city through its streets and squares. I'll search for the one my heart loves. So I looked for him, but did not find him. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? See, there's this repetition, in fact, 4 times in 4 verses, the one my heart loves, which literally is the one my soul loves. In Hebrew thought, or in the Hebrew Bible, the word heart is the seat of the intellect and will. So you think with your heart, you make decisions with your heart. And the soul, which is the Hebrew word here, used here, or is the life, it's the person, it's the centre of need, of longing, of desire. And here we have this repetition that this is her life, this is her desire, this is her need, she's longing. This is consuming her, the one my soul loves. She can think of nothing else but finding her lover. She's unsettled, she's anxious. She's restless. She searches the city, verse 2, but does not find him. She encounters the city watch, verse 3. These shadowy figures of male power. She asks them, but they provide no help. And then verse 4, scarcely had I passed them when I found the one my heart loves. I held him and would not let him go, till I'd brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me. See, this first dream ends with a happy resolution. She finds the one her soul loves. And her anxiety and her feelings of insecurity are evident in her actions. She held him. She wouldn't let him go. She brought him into her mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived her. This country girl in her dream imagines a place that is private and safe and secure. There in the shelter of the family home, her mother's maternal care, in that inner chamber, there are no watchmen of the city. There's no King Solomon. It's a place where the couple could be together without threat or without interference. A place of intimacy. The proper place for sexuality. And in verse 5, following this dream, she gives a charge to the daughters of Jerusalem. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. In light of the power of love that had taken hold of her soul, that was consuming her, that filled her with longing and restlessness, love that led to crazy dreams like this one, she says to the other girls, don't arouse or awaken love until it so desires. The second episode, second dream, chapter 3, verses 6 to 11, the wilderness of Solomon's bed. Now, the traditional way these verses are understood is as a wedding procession. As a wedding procession. In fact, in the ESV Bible, the heading for this section of chapter 3 is Solomon arrives for his wedding. And then in chapter 4, the heading is Solomon admires his bride's beauty. And I think there are some pretty reasonable arguments that can be advanced for that reading, for seeing this as a wedding procession concerning Solomon. Now, what are the strongest arguments for seeing this as a wedding, procession? Well, I think there is, of course, the explicit mention of the day of Solomon's wedding in verse 11. What's more, in chapter 4, verses 8 to 11, chapter 4, verse 8 to 5, verse 1, the male lover repeatedly calls the woman my sister, my bride. And this is the only place in Song of Songs where that word bride is used. So following on from the mention of a wedding in chapter 11, in verse 11, 3 verse 11, we have this repetition of bride in chapter 4. And then there is in chapter 3 verse 9, this word that NIV translates as carriage. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. And if that's how we're to translate it, then what we have here is a picture of perhaps a sedan chair, like it was carried along by servants, an ornate chair that a king or a noble would sit on for transport. Or perhaps a chair that was carried along by a chariot, whatever the case. Now, that's how it's traditionally understood, and I think there are some reasonable arguments for reading it that way. And that view is kind of how you have to take these chapters if you see Song of Songs as only being about two main characters, Solomon and his bride. But once you sort of imagine that this book may actually be about three main characters, it opens up some other possibilities to how you might understand this section. So this is where I want you to turn to that little handout I gave you with the fill in the blanks, which were going to come up on the screen, I haven't written them down in my notes, so we'll have to wing it a little bit, but we'll see how we go. As I'm explaining this, I'm just to point out, I'm going to be drawing on quite heavily on this commentary, Ian Proven, the NIV application commentary. So if you want to sort of read further at this, you can get some of the arguments in there. That said, I have I've been working at it hard myself, because it's a new way of thinking about this chapter, and although I am not certain, I think I'm persuaded. I'm persuaded that this is how we should read it. You see, when I looked at it, there are a lot of words in the Hebrew which the NIV translates a certain way on the assumption that it's a wedding procession. But once that assumption is removed, there are actually some more natural ways to translate them. Now, Song of Songs is a difficult book, and this chapter is difficult. There's much disagreement about it. And just before we get into it, I just want to point out, not every part of the Bible is as tricky as this bit. I don't want you to feel like you can't read the Bible because it won't make sense to you. This is a particularly difficult part, but not every part is as hard as this. And you certainly don't need to know Hebrew to be able to read the Bible. Like, English translations are excellent. And in fact, if you're interested in following this in greater depth, I can show you some tools that, as someone who doesn't know Hebrew, will let you look into the very things I'm talking about here. So even though you don't have Hebrew, you've got to use a bit of caution, but some tools that will help you access some of what I'm saying as an English speaker. Look, I don't want you to feel like the Bible's hard to read. I don't want you to feel like it's inaccessible. However, that said, the Bible does take careful attention, and it does at times require all the powers of your intellect. I want you to apply your mind to His Word, and so let's do that for the next few moments together as we look at this section of chapter 3. So I'll read it out in the NIV, and then I'm going to talk through some of the verses. So I'll read out first in the NIV. 3 verse 6 to 11. Who is this coming up from the desert, like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it's Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon, its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Jerusalem, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. Now, on the traditional reading, as NIV has it, in verse 7 you have mention of Solomon's carriage, and then verse 9 again, the carriage. And the understanding there is that these two structures are described, two words are describing the same structure. However, they are different words. They're different words in Hebrew. The word in verse 7 is the word mitar, and the word in verse 9 is the word aparon. The word in verse 9, aparon, this is the only place it occurs in the Hebrew Bible. So you can't really kind of base much on it alone. Because we don't have much to compare it with to see how that word would be used elsewhere. So we kind of got to understand what aparon means from the context. And it may well be some kind of carriage, some kind of sedan chair. I think there's possibly some reasons for that. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But the second thing about that verse in verse 9 is that NIV adds the word the, that definite article, the carriage, implying that it's the same structure just spoken about in verses 6 to 8. However, the definite article isn't there. It just says an aparon, a structure. It may or may not be exactly the same one that's mentioned in verse 7. So that sort of throws this passage open to us. Well, let's look at some of the verses in detail. So you've got the verse there, but you fill in the blanks. First point from verse 6, who is this coming up? The word who there is a personal word. So it's not the question what, it's the question who. It expects an answer that is a person, or perhaps a nation or a city or something like that, but definitely a personal answer, not so much an object. Who is this? The word this is feminine. That is, the answer to the question who is this must be a woman. So the answer is not going to be Solomon. It's expecting a feminine answer, which could be mita, the word I mentioned that's translated carriage in verse 7, because that's a feminine noun. Although that's an object, and the most natural answer you would expect to this question is a woman. Who is this? Is asking, who is this woman? Who is this woman? Now, NIV then has, who is this coming up from the desert? Coming up, that expression, that sort of assumes a horizontal movement toward the person who's viewing the spectacle. Coming up, like coming up towards me as I watch. A bit like you might say someone's coming up from Broadmeadow towards the university. You know, if we see someone coming up from Broadmeadow, imagine we can see them. That's kind of what's been described here. And so the image there in NIV is someone coming up from the desert, perhaps toward Jerusalem. But the word that's translated coming up doesn't necessarily have to be translated that way. It can just be going up. It can be rising up. It doesn't necessarily assume that perspective of approach toward the one who's viewing it. So the way you've got to understand and translate this word depends on the context. What do we see? Like, is it coming up? Is it going up? Is it rising up from the desert? Well, let's look at the context. Who is this woman coming up or going up or rising up from the desert like a column of smoke? See, what's being pictured here is this column of smoke ascending from the wilderness. The next little bit we have is perfumed with myrrh and incense. Now, the verb that's translated there is perfumed. This is, in one sense, this is the only time it occurs in that particular passive form in the Old Testament. But it's a common verb. It occurs 114 times in the Old Testament. And in every single one of those occurrences, except this one, it always refers to burning a sacrificial offering or incense. It always refers to offering up a sacrifice in smoke to God or to a God or burning incense to a God. Now that starts to fall in place with going up like a column of smoke, doesn't it? Who is this woman, rising up from the desert, from the wilderness, like a column of smoke, offered up with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant. Incense there is a particular incense that's often used in sacrifices as well. So there's a lot of sacrificial imagery here. In fact, the word coming up in the form it's in, the Hebrew form olah, is identical to the word burnt offering. And that verb's often used also for making offerings, offering a sacrifice up. So what we have here in verse 6, I think, is a picture of a sacrifice. A woman who is rising up like a column of smoke because she's been offered as a sacrifice with myrrh and incense made from all the spices of merchant. We now have a very different picture of what's taking place here. Let's go on to the next verse. Look, it's Solomon's carriage. Now the word carriage, NIV is translating that as carriage because it's assuming it's the same structure as verse 9 and using that kind of slightly cryptic word apeiron in verse 9 to understand this one here in verse 7. But the actual Hebrew word is a fairly simple one, mitar, which just means bed or couch. That's how you'd normally translate it. And a bed or a couch certainly doesn't imply movement. Now, sometimes a bed can be lifted up. In 1 Samuel chapter 19, David's sick on his bed and King Saul orders him to be carried on his bed to the king, although it's not David, it's actually a household idol put there by Michal. So sometimes a bed can be moved, but normally a bed's fixed. Normally, you know, a bed or a couch is a fixed piece of furniture. So look, it's Solomon's bed. Who is this rising up from Solomon's bed like a pillar of smoke, like a sacrificial victim? Look, it's Solomon's bed. Now the next line, they're escorted by 60 warriors. Escorted in NIV is another English word that's been chosen on the assumption that what's described here is horizontal movement towards the person viewing it rather than some other form of movement. But it's just the word surrounded. It doesn't necessarily mean escorted in a procession, it just means surrounded. It's the same kind of word that's used in of the watchmen in verse 3 who go around the city. Look, it's Solomon's bed, surrounded by 60 warriors. NIV has the noblest of Israel, there's actually just a repetition there, surrounded by 60 warriors from the warriors of Israel. This emphasis of the word warriors. And then the description of these men of war continues in verse 8. NIV has all of them wearing the sword. Literally, that's all of them held by the sword. The same verb as in verse 4 where the girl held her lover. They're firmly gripped by their swords. Maybe they're girded by their swords, but they're men of war, they're dedicated to their profession. So what's this image we have here in verses 6 to 8? We have the king's bed surrounded by men of war, armed to the teeth, trained for battle, and a female sacrificial offering rising in smoke from the wilderness. This heavily defended bed. One wonders actually, reading of how heavily Solomon's bed is defended, whether these warriors are there to keep enemies out or to keep women in. And then on to verse 9, King Solomon made for himself an apharon, whatever it is, let's say it's a carriage, it's a dance chair. He made it from the wood of Lebanon. Now, Solomon used the wood of Lebanon to build all kinds of things. He used it to build the temple. He used it to build his palace. He used so much wood in his palace that his palace was known as the House of the Forest of Lebanon. Well, let's look at what this structure is in verse 9. In verse 10, it seems like it's a very solid structure. Its posts he made of silver. The posts could be pillars there. These are like the substantial supports Solomon used in his palace, these pillars. It's pillars he made of silver. Its base of gold, its heavy metals involved. Its seat was upholstered with purple, the NIV has. Literally it's something like its chariot of purple. Its chariot, or perhaps its chariot seat. So here we do have an idea of a structure that can move around. Although it's not clear whether the movement is literal or metaphorical. If literal, we're thinking of a sedan chair or a chariot. If metaphorical, we may still be talking about Solomon's bed, the bed on which Solomon goes on his journeys seeking for love in the night, just as the woman went on her journey in 3 verses 1 to 5. But his journeys are conducted in a chariot, a vehicle of strength and power. Next line, its interior lovingly inlaid. Literally there is paved with love. Like paved as in putting down a stone pavement, which again adds to this impression of strength and solidity. But love there, I don't think it's talking about being carefully decorated by artists who adore the king. I think that's referring to the king's acts of lovemaking. It is paved with love, with his lovemaking with the daughters of Jerusalem. See, what we have here is a description of Solomon's sexual conquests in his bed, as one after another, women are offered up as sacrificial victims. And then we read in verse 11, "Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced." Now, it doesn't actually say that this dream took place is of the wedding day itself. If it is a dream of the wedding day, then what's being described is one more sacrificial victim being brought to Solomon's bed. But it may just, the crown from the wedding day may just be a sad and ironic reminder that Solomon rejoiced at his first wedding. He still wears the crown he wore at his first wedding. And yet with great folly he imagined that the joy he had at his first wedding could be multiplied by multiplying weddings. If he delighted in one woman, then more women would increase his delight, not realising that the reverse, in fact, was the truth. See, what we have here in chapter 3 is a stark contrast In 3 verse 4, this picture of love and intimacy in a relationally secure context, the family home, maternal protection. And then in the second half of chapter 3, Solomon's bed, a place of coercion, surrounded by fearsome warriors, royal power and sexual conquest. No, friends, legally as a society we have made some great advances from that day. Polygamy is illegal. Women are no longer owned by men. There are greater legal protections for women. But there are still many ways today in which men continue to sacrifice women on the altar of sex and power. Sexual abuse continues, brothels, pornography, a massive pornographic industry, and that is growing. I read an article, this was written a few weeks ago, a few years ago, I think from 2006, but at that time the pornography industry has larger revenues than Microsoft, Google, Amazon, eBay, Yahoo, Apple and Netflix combined. 2006 worldwide pornography revenues ballooned to $97 billion. Women's sport is increasingly sexualised. Uniforms become shorter, tighter, scantier. And there's the introduction of blatant sexualisation in sports like the Lingerie Football League. There's the practice of serial monogamy and of divorce, where men move from one woman to the next. And now it's true it's not just men who play these games of sex and power. One response by women is to reciprocate in kind and use sex to exercise power over men. The early chapters of the Book of Proverbs warn men about women who use their physical charms to lure them into adultery. Women can play the same game too, but it's still the case generally that men have more sheer power, and that women are more often than not the victims. Chapter 4, the next dream, gives us an alternate vision of love. In Song of Songs chapter 4, the man is not coercing, but wooing. He praises her beauty. Chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are dark. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. He goes on to describe her teeth, her lips, her temples, her neck. I think it's probably significant that his description begins with her eyes. That place of personal connection and intimacy. He meets this woman not as a sexual object, but in the context of relationship, person to person, seeing each other. And he only travels from her eyes to the features of her face, her neck, and in verse 5 to 6, the image again of her two breasts as mountains of incense, an image that the woman herself invited the man to use in chapter 2. In verse 8 he beckons, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Senir, from the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens, and the mountain haunts of the leopards. He beckons her. Now Lebanon and Mount Hermon, they were remote places. This is sort of the northern border of Israel. Not only remote in its distance, but also remote in its height. Snow-capped mountains. And a place of danger too, a place of lions and leopards. He beckons to his woman. You've stolen my heart, verse 1. You've stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You've stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes. Verse 10, how delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. And then in verse 12, he describes her as a locked garden. Verse 12, you are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You're a springing closed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. And what we have described here is an impossible paradise filled with fruits and spices from all the corners of the known world at the time. No such earthly garden would have contained this diversity. It reminds us of Genesis chapter 2. It's a well-watered garden, a place of abundance and richness and arousal and desire. He describes the woman and her body and her sexuality in this way. And yet the man recognises that he has no power to coerce her. He won't force her. He admires her beauty, he admires the fruit of her garden, but he does not hold the key. He cannot unlock the gate. Verse 16, the woman responds, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruit." She responds by alluring and inviting him. 5 verse 1, "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I've drunk my wine and my milk." There's this celebration of love. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. See, friends, what we have here pictured in chapter 4 is a very different kind of relationship. Not the wilderness of Solomon's bed, but the garden of pure love. A relationship that is exclusive. A relationship of mutual desire and delight. A relationship free from coercion or power. One of self-giving, wooing, and praise. Now the final episode, we've run out of time, the final episode is another dream sequence. It mirrors the first dream sequence, and yet it ends tragically. For this time when she encounters the city watch, we read in verse 7, "The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls." So once again we see the ugliness of men mistreating women in their despicable games of sex and power. Friends, we live in a sad and tragic world. We saw last week it's a place of beauty, but it's also a sad and tragic world in which women search for love and in doing so find themselves physically and emotionally used and abused. And in a world in which men are twisted and warped as they surrender to dark forces within them, which they themselves do not even begin to understand. Genesis 3:16, "Your desire will be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." Friends, that's a description of relationships after the fall. And that's not just what society is like. Those same dark and destructive forces are at work in you. Men, and women too, as you dream of love and search for love, it's a dangerous quest. There are dangers without and dangers within. And yet in the midst of all this darkness, the Song of Songs holds forth a different way of relating and a different way of being. A love between man and woman, between husband and wife, which is in a sense a microcosm of all true human relationships. Relationships in which people are not treated as objects used to serve your own ambition and pleasure. In which people are not used as stepping stones you trample over in your bid for power. But in which others are met as persons, beautifully and wonderfully made in the image of God, bearing their own dignity, integrity, freedom and nobility, treated with love and respect. Relationships that aren't about power, but about service. That aren't about coercion, but about invitation. That aren't about conquest, but about surrender. That aren't about using, but about giving. Relationships in which desire is accompanied by love, and sex is robed with intimacy. Relationships in which people are honoured as persons in mutual love and self-giving. Now, a few years ago, NCS ran a mission on the theme, Enjoy the Ultimate Sex. And the speaker described relationships that worked this way. He shared some experiences from his life. He spoke of men who treated women in this way. And one non-Christian girl who was at the meeting wrote this in response. You talked about guys that had your perspective on ultimate sex. Where in Newcastle do I meet genuine guys like that? I haven't met any. Where do you go to learn a different way of relating and a different way of being? You learn it from the God who loves you like that. You learn it from a God who has infinite power and yet wants us to come willingly. From a God who doesn't compel us, but who invites us. From a God who has given himself so completely, even to death on a cross, that we delight to answer his call. This is a God with power to heal, because this is how God loves us. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we long for love, and yet our search for love is so often troubled by darkness, not only in the world around us, but even in our own hearts. Teach us to love as you loved. Amen.